You know, when kids think of camp, they think of s'mores, crafting, swimming. When you talk to Cambridge parents about camp, they seem stressed. There's so many options. There are wait lists. They all have different registration deadlines. So if you're a parent out there and you've been either throwing up your hands or struggling to find the right camp for your kid, I have a little insider info for you. The Outback Summer Program at the Mariah L. Baldwin Community Center is a high-quality summer experience for families who value creativity, culture, and community. Outback is for rising kindergartners through rising sixth graders, and they even have an extended day option. Your kid's going to do sports, ceramics, visual arts, performing arts, but they're also going to be spending a ton of time outside, whether they're just running through a sprinkler or enjoying weekly trips to Singing Beach in Manchester by the Sea. That's in addition to all the other awesome field trips and special events throughout the summer. I'm very familiar with this camp. I actually have a lot of friends who send their kids there because it's right in my neighborhood. Everyone loves it. Outback currently has openings or very small wait lists throughout the summer, especially for students who will be entering kindergarten in the fall. Anyone interested in enrolling can learn more on their website, agassiz.org, that's AGASSIZ.org, or by contacting registration at agassiz.org. Stop stressing and sign up. Hi, all. I'm Lee Stabert, and welcome back to Explain Boston to Me. Let's do our quick refresher. In August 2022, I moved with my family from Philadelphia, my hometown, to the Boston area. I've always prided myself in being the person who knows all the hyperlocal minutia. I know that I wish I could serve tomato pie at my Super Bowl shindig. This room temperature bakery delight features a focaccia-like base and a very thick layer of tomato sauce. It's topped with Parmesan cheese and sliced into strips or squares. It's a Philadelphia graduation party, football watching, birthday party staple, and we loved the version from Sarcone's on 9th Street. And I know that sometimes I crave a walk along Forbidden Drive in the Wissahickon. It's unbelievable that this wooded trail, part of the Fairmount Park network, is within the city limits. I love Fresh Pond, but this is something else. I want that kind of deep knowledge of my new home. I want to know at what point I can expect it to feel like spring up here. We talk in late March, early April. Help me out. And I want to know when the next batch of Red Sox single game tickets is going on sale. I need to nab some Philly Sox tickets. They're doing a 3-game stand here in June. Look for me there. I'll be in a maroon cap with a vintage P. Unfortunately, the original red looks a little manga these days. I will be giggling at the antics of Brandon Marsh and talking about the fact that if Bryce Harper brings a World Series to Philly, he will be a god in that town. Well, I guess I just made my Boston one about Philly. Like, so be it. So I'm asking for help. I'm finding people to explain these things to me. I'll never be a native, but I just might learn to speak the language. I was going to start this little riffy part with saying, you know, a few things impress me, but that's not really true. This season of Traders, my own homemade fried rice, people with a large collection of chunky sweaters, all these things impress me. But when I hear that a dude with two kids and a full-time high-pressure job has written an 800-page history of Boston in his spare time, well, that actually blows my mind. Dan Dane, lawyer, author, multitasker extraordinaire, joins me on this episode to talk about downtown, from its pre-colonial history through its recent renaissance. So can you please introduce yourself and give a brief rundown on what you do and why you're qualified to speak on Boston culture and on this topic, downtown Boston in particular?
Thank you for having me on. I am Daniel Dane, D-A-I-N. I was born in Boston, lived in Brighton as a baby, grew up in Newton just outside the city. Then I lived in Beacon Hill after school, college and law school. Then I lived in Beacon Hill, moved out to Needham. But I have worked in downtown Boston for the last 28 years. And I wrote a book that was published in September called A History of Boston and spend a lot of time talking about downtown as well as all the other neighborhoods.
So how did you decide to write this book? Because this is not your day job.
No, I am a practicing attorney representing real estate developers in Boston. I did not set out intending to write an 800-page book on the history of Boston. It actually surprised me that when I got into my project, which I started in December of 2017, that there was not a sort of comprehensive history of the city. But I just was fascinated by the city and its history and spent a lot of time giving tours to people from out of town, and just always wanted to know the city even deeper than I did. And I started a project of just doing research and taking notes. And then the notes got longer and longer, and the more questions I asked, the more research I did. And about 2 years into the project, I said, you know, geez, I should turn this into a book.
I'm very impressed by anyone who can multitask like this.
I loved it so much. I loved every second of the research and writing. And so it was really sort of a fun thing to do. But having a full-time job and having two kids that are in high school now, I'm on a lot of different boards and civic organizations as well. So it meant a lot of late nights. But I generally worked between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. each night for the 4 years I did the research and writing.
Wow. Very cool. Okay, so we're going to talk about downtown Boston. First, we need a geography lesson. How would you define downtown Boston?
So today, it's roughly bounded by, I would say, Chinatown and the Theater District to the south. Working your way around, come up Tremont Street, it'd be bounded by Boston Common to the west and the Back Bay, Beacon Hill. Continue to circle around West End, North End, Government Center, and then down through the waterfront and Four Point Channel back to the Leather District in Chinatown.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of this part of the city. What has it looked like over the centuries? And really, when did it become codified as like the central business district, the place where people go to do business and then later to build tall buildings?
It looks very different today from how it looked at the time the Massachusetts Native American tribe settled the area. There's archaeological evidence of first peoples in this area about 9 to 12,000 years ago. There's more direct evidence of the area being settled approximately 4,000 years ago in a period called the Archaic Period. The evidence is mostly in the form of arrowheads and fishwares that have been discovered in the bay, in the Back Bay. And then it was the Algonquian language group is a series of tribes that lived in this area for several thousand years. Most specifically, it was the Massachusetts that lived in the area of what's today downtown Boston. To the south, there were the Wampanoags in southeastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island. You had the Nauset on Cape Cod and the Nipmucks and various other Native American tribes in the area. In 1616, there was a ship of French explorers that shipwrecked on Cape Cod. And the people on the ship were attacked by the Nauset, who were upset about prior European expeditions that had kidnapped Native Americans and brought them back to Europe. The Nauset took four of the French explorers hostage, essentially, and they had some kind of disease at the time, which has variously been thought to be potentially hepatitis or yellow fever, possibly smallpox. And it unleashed between 1616 and 1619 a tremendous pandemic that wiped out somewhere between 75 and 90% of the Native Americans who lived along the coast of Massachusetts. 1619, an English explorer, Thomas Dermier, was in the vicinity of Plymouth, what's today Plymouth. This is before the Pilgrims arrived, and he wrote in his diary, "All dead," referring to the village of Patuxent, which is where Plymouth was. So the Massachusetts—
They don't mention this at Thanksgiving.
The Wampanoags, who lived a little bit further to the south, were greatly weakened, but still survived in the area of Rhode Island. But the Massachusetts, in particular, in the Boston area, was decimated. Such that when a little hermit named William Blaxton, who had come to the coast of Massachusetts with explorers in 1624, made his way north from where they originally landed to what was called the Shamit Peninsula and set up a house, the Shamit Peninsula, which is today's downtown Boston, was essentially empty of people. In 1630 was a great Puritan migration from England, fleeing persecution of a group of people who wanted to purify the Church of England. They were known as Puritans. Originally, there were 17 ships that sailed from England to Massachusetts, originally coming to Salem in 1613. On the first ship was John Winthrop on the Arbella. He made his way south from Salem, looking for a good place to settle, and came down to Charlestown, which had previously been settled by a few Puritan families the year before. And so they set up tents in Charlestown, and then this hermit, the Reverend William Blaxton, who had been living by himself on the Shamet Peninsula since 1624 in a little house approximately where Charles Street and Beacon Streets meet today. He came over and visited them and said, you know, there's really not very good fresh water in Charlestown, but there's lovely springs across the Charles River. And these names actually had been named a little bit earlier, particularly by John Smith, who explored the area from 1614 to 1616. But at any rate, Winthrop and his fellow Puritans crossed the Charles River to the Shamet Peninsula. And thank you very much, William Blaxton. And his land was approximately where Boston Common is today. But the Shamet Peninsula was a peninsula. It was much, much smaller than the Boston of today, which was later transformed in the 19th century through landfill, through knocking down the hills to fill in the water. First, the waterfront in the very early 19th century. And of course, later, the South End and Back Bay, much of East Boston. East Boston historically was a series of small islands. So much of that is landfill. South Boston was a small peninsula off of Dorchester.
So when did, again, like this area of downtown Boston, when did the terminology downtown even start? When did this idea of like, there's a place that everyone goes, that is the center? And then when did this place in Boston become that place?
So the different names of neighborhoods change over time and locations change. So the North End was really the North End for a long time, going back quite a long way. What's today sort of the remnants of the West End, which was raised in the 1950s during urban renewal, historically was called West Boston, and included what we consider today the North Slope of Beacon Hill. The South End at the time, of course, today's South End was from landfill in the 1840s. So the historic South End really was the downtown crossing area extending into sort of the theater district. And there was quite a rivalry between the North End, which was the working waterfront, more working class, very dense, and then the South End in today's downtown crossing area. So what we think of as today's downtown historically was more of a residential neighborhood. The financial district would have been where people had houses, larger houses, and a little bit wealthier in colonial times. The real downtown in the colonial period was along what was called King Street, which is today's State Street, of course. After the Revolution, they would not have continued to have a name named after the King of England, but changed it to State Street for obvious reasons. And that is where the center of colonial and early federal economy is based, the stretch down State Street out to Long Wharf and into the harbor. A transformative event to downtown happens in 1872, which is the Great Fire, which wipes out the whole area that we consider downtown Boston and gets rebuilt as a little bit more of a business district, sort of coinciding with the march of blocks to the west as the Back Bay is filled in. And then the more well-to-do Yankees move to the Back Bay, fleeing the Irish Catholics who have moved into the waterfront, starting in, you know, with the potato famine in about 1848 and continuing into the 1850s.
As any longtime listeners will know, I've moved twice in the last 2 years. Moving stinks, especially here in the Boston area, where, as we've established, most people move on the same day, and you run the risk of storrowing your U-Haul and ending up on the local news. How embarrassing. But it doesn't have to be so hard. Let Premium Q do it for you. This local moving company can not only load and unload the truck, they also offer packing services. If you've never had someone pack for you, especially if you have young kids, you are missing out. If you're new to town, figuring out all the strange things about Boston should be your priority, not wrapping each wine glass individually in little layers of paper. Reach out to Premium Q now and, for a limited time, get free moving boxes and 10% off your upcoming move. To get a quote, head to moversinboston.com or call 781-730-6180. Now you can focus more on your new home and less on the logistics of packing and schlepping. So it seems like I have a question on my discussion guide about sort of the big inflection points for downtown. It sounds like this fire was one, and then mass immigration sounds like also played a role in sort of the shifting populations around this part of Boston.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Great Fire took out dozens of blocks downtown, enormous damage. It starts in the area around Summer Street and Franklin Street and spreads to the north and really wipes out downtown Boston at the same time that a lot of the institutions that had been downtown reopen in the Back Bay. So, for instance, one of the most famous buildings in the area in colonial times actually gets saved. The fire stops right at its doorstep, which is the Old South Meeting House. And I believe it was called the Old South Meeting House at the time. But the congregation then moves to the Back Bay and opens a magnificent building in today's Copley Square called the New Old South Church.
Creative.
Yeah. So you see all these congregations moving from the historic downtown area to the Back Bay. And you see other institutions opening in the Back Bay in the latter half of the 19th century. So you see institutions like Massachusetts Institute of Technology originally opens in the Back Bay. You have a natural history museum, a precursor to the science museum opening. You have, of course, the Boston Public Library. You have the Museum of Fine Arts, which opens originally in Copley Square before moving further out on Huntington Avenue. But a real migration of the well-to-do Yankees and their institutions from downtown to the Back Bay following the Great Fire and following the period of immigration. Originally the Irish, and then in 1880 approximately is when you have this entirely new immigration from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, the Jews of Eastern Europe and mostly Italians from Southern Europe, as well as Greeks and people from other parts of Europe coming to Boston. And this is a whole different class from the Irish because they don't even speak English. The religions are in some ways, you know, more foreign than the Catholicism practiced by the Irish. As Boston had had almost no Jews at all until really the first Jewish settlements started coming with German migration in the 1840s. So the immigration in the 1880s was a great shock to the Yankee establishment.
So the Blue Bloods, the WASPs, the Brahmins, they flee downtown. What is the first half of the 20th century? What does downtown look like? What does the built environment look like? Who's there? What are they doing there?
In 1920, a transformative event happens across the United States that's felt probably more acutely in New England than anywhere else, which is following the end of World War I and the return of the GIs, triggers a massive deflationary recession after the United States had largely funded its efforts in World War I through printing money. And what happens when there's steep deflation is people stop spending money, because if you're thinking about buying something and you think it's going to be less expensive in a month or 2 months, you'll hold off on that purchase hoping prices drop. And so the economy of the United States largely freezes in 1920 during this deep deflationary recession. The mills of New England respond to this drop in business by looking to relocate to areas with lower labor costs. And so you see a wholesale shutting down of the mills and other industries and manufacturing of New England and moving to the American South and overseas in the 1920s, and a precipitous drop in industrial and manufacturing employment in New England. Boston both has its own manufacturing base as well as being the center for financing industry across New England. And so Boston's economy essentially stagnates and freezes from about 1920 up until the 1990s, really. Although by the 1960s and 70s and 80s, you see a lot of supportive businesses for, to the extent that there was economic activity outside of Boston. So you did see by the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, law firms, banks, accounting firms really moving in, and the building of towers in the financial district, giving people a sense of what downtown Boston was like in the 20th century. In 1915, the Custom House Tower opened at 496 feet. The next time a building taller than the Custom House Tower opened was the Prudential Tower in 1964. So you have 50 years where no new tall buildings were built in Boston. In 1950s, Moody's rated Boston's bond rating at just above junk bond level. As late as the 1980s, the Brookings Institute declared Boston the most blighted big city in the United States. A study by Harvard economist Ed Glaser showed that in the 1980s, 3/4 of all homes in Boston were worth less than the cost of construction. So if you built a house in Boston in the 1980s and then put it on the market, it would go on the market for less than you had just spent to build it. And so, of course, nothing was being built.
I mean, so, I'm especially laughing because I just was editing an episode about renting apartments in Boston and how expensive it is and just how, like, you know, your dollar doesn't go anywhere. Every year the landlords raise rent 25%. So it's just the contrast. It's real.
And this is a phenomenon of the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And was not the case from 1920 really till about 1990. The population in Boston in 1950 was 801,000 people, according to the U.S. Census. The U.S. Census in 1980, the population of Boston was 570,000 people. So, you know, when 230,000 people leave the city in 30 years, demand is much lower than it was before. The city hollowed out. It emptied out, and there was almost no economic activity going on. And the responses of the city to this were exactly the opposite of what you should be doing, which was essentially to tear down diverse, dense, vital neighborhoods and replace them with low density and undiverse neighborhoods. So this is when you get the period of urban renewal. So tearing down the West End and the New York streets, which is part of the South End. You have tearing down a Scully Square to build a government center. I think in 1948, there's a plan for the urban renewal of Boston, and it showed one quarter of all of the land of Boston was slated to be demolished and replaced with low density. You know, the idea was based on some notion of what was good for the city in terms of planning at the time, which is the city was losing people to the suburbs. And so the idea was you wanted to replicate the suburbs in the city. So let's tear down the dense neighborhood and build the suburbs in the city. But it was exactly the opposite of what we should have been doing. We, of course, built highways, which also the highways themselves tore down a lot of land. And so you had huge displacement of people and businesses for building the central artery and the Mass Turnpike. Not that we shouldn't have built, certainly the Turnpike has helped a lot in terms of the city, but the policies were to move people out of the city, and it was quite intentional. It was a great neglected downtown, and it wasn't helped by particularly the administration going back a little earlier to James Michael Curley in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, which was so corrupt that capital really flew the city because investment decisions weren't being made on who had the best plan, but were based on who could line the pockets of the Curley administration the most. And there's a whole bunch of other federal, state, and local policies that conspired across most of the 20th century to tear the city down.
Yeah, and we did an episode on the Big Dig. So we talked about the building of this highway that so quickly was deemed bad and obsolete. Like, that was what was most surprising to me, is just for how few years that highway actually was considered a good idea. I don't know if it was ever... people ever liked it, except for people with very specific commutes. But that's...
Yeah, you know, and the decision to build an elevated highway right through the heart of downtown really tore neighborhoods apart. And the transformation of Boston in the last 30 years, the putting the central artery underground is a major factor in getting people, encouraging people to come back into the city. And we've seen the population now rise to about 670,000, so about 100,000 more people over the last 40 years. And of course, the number would be much higher if we actually built the housing to accommodate the people who want to live here.
Right.
And we should be building more housing and putting more people in Boston, because we are a very job-rich environment. And instead, in the United States, our policies are such that we're building housing in the American Southeast and Southwest, which is really the worst places to put the housing, because the carbon consumption per capita is way higher than when we build the housing in dense urban centers. And they're low job environments instead of rich job environments. So we build the housing in exactly the wrong places. And these are products of policies that are enacted with good and sometimes bad intentions at the local, state, and federal levels.
So if someone in the 1950s and 60s said, I'm going downtown, what business are they doing? Are they doing government business? Are they still going to maybe see a show? Are there any institutions that kind of endured throughout this period of mega upheaval that still drew people into the city, even if they were driving in from the suburbs?
Well, I mean, one of the big draws at the time for people to come from the suburbs into the city were the department stores. And so this is sort of the early, you know, 50s, 60s, and I grew up in Boston in the 70s and 80s. This is still early for suburban shopping malls. And so Downtown Crossing still had a lot of appeal. And these downtown department stores sort of slowly start closing across the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s as they can't compete first with shopping that's built in the suburbs, and then with the internet by the 1990s. You know, people still work downtown. That was part of the reason for building the highways. People moved out to the suburbs. And I really do want to emphasize that the migration of people to the suburbs was not something that naturally occurred, that it was, again, through intentional policies to move people to the suburbs. We adopt on a federal level tax policies that the home mortgage interest deduction is an enormous federal subsidization of private home ownership that we don't that was not provided to people who rented. So a great transfer of wealth from renters in the city to homeowners in the suburbs. The way we finance public schools through property taxes, a whole series of decisions that are made to encourage people to move out to the suburbs, as well as marketing campaigns, this notion of the American dream. There's nothing natural about the American dream being homeowners owning a single family home in the suburbs. And I own a single family home in the suburbs, so I'm not trying to trash it, but we should just understand and think about why that is, why the American dream is defined that way. And it's defined that way through a marketing campaign that starts in the 1920s. These are decisions that are made for right or wrong, but they have had consequences.
So people who are coming downtown to shop or do business, I mean, to project backwards, like, what do you think their impression was? What was the brand, if you will, to use a little bit of anachronism, of downtown Boston in that era, in the 50s, 60s, that before 1990, when things started to change?
Very bad impression. Boston was seen as a dangerous city. Yeah. I had a discussion with someone recently who moved to Boston in 1972, and the broker told him that he was looking at an apartment at a part of the city. The broker told him it was the theft center of Boston. And he said, you know what street it was? And I said, no, what street was it? And he said, Marlboro Street in the Back Bay, which is just about the most expensive street in the entire city today.
Yeah.
After he moved into Marlboro Street in 1972, he went out of town for the weekend. And when he came back, the entire contents of his apartment had been stolen. So Boston was a place that was viewed as dangerous by people who didn't live in the city, and by people who lived in the city as well. It was polluted. We've been cleaning the city up for the last 70 or 80 years. The harbor was polluted. The Charles River was polluted. You know, by the 1990s, we start cleaning those up. It was dirty. There's a great website called Dirty Old Boston and a book that really was the case. You had the combat zone, which was after Scully Square was raised. There was essentially a policy to try to concentrate vice entertainment in an area in today's theater district along Lower Washington Street, known as the combat zone. And it was just a very different city from today.
So we've touched a little bit in the course of doing all these episodes on the Massachusetts Miracle and on Dukakis and, you know, this change that does happen. But can you, in your words, what do you think is going on in the 80s into the 90s to make this change and to have dollars and eyeballs and people wanting to live and be downtown in a new way?
So my real passion through my job representing developers in Boston is understanding what makes cities successful in urbanism. And the Massachusetts Miracle, since you bring it up, is one of the most fascinating points of our relative recent history. And, you know, the Massachusetts Miracle, so successful in certain ways of measuring economic success. Massachusetts in the 1980s is the lowest unemployment in the United States. And Governor Dukakis rides the success of the Massachusetts economy all the way to the Democratic nomination for president in 1988. But the Massachusetts Miracle was really interesting if you dig in a little further. Massachusetts Miracle was based on a series of companies largely focused on personal computers in the 1970s and into the 1980s. They locate not in Boston, but they locate in the suburbs.
Route 128.
Largely clustered around America's Technology Highway, Route 128. But even though they're clustered in an area, they're isolated from each other in suburban office campuses where people drive from suburban homes to a suburban office building surrounded by parking. They drive there, they park, they spend the entire day in the office building, they get in their car and they drive home. Now, each of these companies had a single good idea, but by being isolated from other people, they were not being challenged and new ideas weren't being created. And so by being isolated in suburban office campuses, none of these companies were able to innovate a second time. And when you had the rise of the internet in the 1990s, none of the Massachusetts Miracle companies were able to pivot. And Massachusetts, as a technology hub, gets passed and lapped by Silicon Valley. And pretty much every single one of the Massachusetts Miracle companies from the 1970s and 1980s is out of business today. You have Wang Computers and Apollo Computers and Digital and all these other companies that are located here. None of them came up with a second innovative idea, and they're all out of business. And that was a major lesson that was learned by new companies starting in the 1990s and into the 2000s, which is you cannot continue to innovate by isolating yourself away from other people with diverse and different ideas. You need to be in an area where people interact. And that was part of the lesson that was learned from the Massachusetts Miracle. Essentially, the lesson that's learned from the failure of the Massachusetts Miracle, ultimate failure of the Massachusetts Miracle, as well as this is the success of Silicon Valley. And so you see companies returning to Boston in the 1990s, trying to do something different and going to places like East Cambridge, where employees of these companies are interacting with other employees and constantly innovating. And it transforms our economy into a knowledge-based economy in the 1990s.
So how does that change downtown? And are there any big landmark companies that decide to move downtown? Or is it mostly just those support industries of law and finance, et cetera, that grow in conjunction with the growth in technology and biotech, et cetera?
So, you know, it's a really fascinating development of where companies are located from the 1990s to today. So, you know, as we've talked about, and as your question notes, downtown becomes through the 60s, 70s, and 80s the location where law firms, banks, and accounting firms are located. They're located in office towers, and they're designed to attract people who live in the suburbs. The lobbies of these office towers are full of all this marble and high ceilings, and the idea is to be impressive to, you know, boards of directors that come and visit these companies. It's all single use. They're not building any housing in downtown. There aren't any restaurants. So people in the 60s, 70s, and 80s are driving into downtown Boston, or thankfully there's a reinvestment in the commuter rail. So some people are taking commuter rail into Boston, but they're working in these downtown office towers and they're getting their cars and they're driving home. What you then see in the 1990s is a clustering of high tech and biotech companies really starting in East Cambridge, and it explodes in success. And so East Cambridge becomes the area with the highest rents. And then this really quite great vision for what becomes a seaport in the, you know, the 2000s and particularly in the 2010s is another cluster of really of life science companies. And so you see downtown sort of not being able to compete any longer and rents being much lower than the rents that are being attracted in East Boston, the seaport, and even in the Back Bay where people live, and it's much more of a 24/7 neighborhood. And so what's interesting is these downtown towers are trying to now compete, and they're almost all the downtown towers have redone their lobbies, and they're much less worried about impressing, you know, a director or a client that's coming in and viewing these lobbies, but they're putting in coffee shops and trying to put in restaurants and sitting areas and places where people can mingle. And so downtown really is trying to keep up, but it becomes a place where there's a lot of Class B office space. And so as East Cambridge and the seaport become too expensive for startup companies, downtown is now the area where a lot of these startup companies were coming to. In the 2010s, before the pandemic, you see the rise of WeWork and WorkBar and Cambridge Innovation Center, where you have this sort of clustering within buildings of startup type businesses. And of course, then the pandemic hits and largely empties downtown out because it doesn't have the base of residential where people can live.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, we have to acknowledge it's a lot of this is like a branding challenge and just convincing people that this is a place where a young, cool company would be or where you could live. Speaking from just Philadelphia, which like all these cities had a very similar challenge and then had a very charismatic mayor, Ed Rendell, and Center City District, where they had like a lot of public-private partnerships to try to bring downtown back. I mean, a lot of these same conversations and a lot of the success came down to redoing the public spaces, having activations, having events, these silly events like Wednesday happy hours across all of Center City. And they seem very slight, but they can really have a big impact on just how people view their urban spaces that they move through.
I mean, I think that there's a lot more study of how to bring people together. And I think businesses are more invested in it now than ever before. You know, one thing that's interesting is historically, part of the reason the Massachusetts Miracle companies were being located in the suburbs is their oldest employees were considered the most valuable. People would start in a company young and work their way up and make middle management and then upper management. People in upper management were making these decisions to locate in the suburbs. But what's happened with the new economy is the most valuable employees are not the oldest employees, but the most valuable employees often are the youngest employees because these are the people who are constantly bringing in new ideas. And so suddenly, locational decisions are being made by companies not based on the needs of their oldest employees and senior management who most likely are living, you know, in further out in the suburbs on large parcels and driving everywhere. But instead, what's driving it is attracting the best talent who are often very young. And this younger generation, there's much greater rejection of high carbon impact living, a movement away from being car dependent, people wanting to be able to walk and also work hard, but also have more opportunities for, you know, experiential, you know, living and activities. And so there's a real demand for that. And so how cities adjust to that and how cities are able to keep people in the city is really important from an economic perspective. It's hugely important in terms of if we can build the housing to keep people in the city, it's hugely important from the affordability perspective. It's hugely important from our climate crisis, because we know that building densely in places where that get people out of their cars is the best, certainly the best land use response we have to the climate crisis. And statistics on carbon usage for people who live downtown or in Cambridge, the amount of carbon they consume is half or less than the carbon consumed by someone who lives in Concord or Weston. And that's almost entirely driven by people's car usage, as well as the fact that we know that multi-use buildings consume much less carbon than single-use building on a per capita basis. And for Boston, the climate crisis is one that's particularly acute in terms of rising sea level projections. Boston is considered one of the most exposed cities in the world. It's often, you know, there's different ways of measuring it, but in many lists, it's considered one of the 10 most vulnerable cities in the world for rising sea level, in part because so much of our infrastructure is underground and not protected. And you look at flood maps in 2050 and 2070, and it's really quite scary.
Great. No, I mean, it's real. It's real. And my next question, first of all, I want to talk about downtown today, but then I want to talk about downtown tomorrow with quotes in the future. But so downtown today, what does it feel like? What does it look like? I mean, you're there all the time. You work down there. My only reasons that I've gone down there, I had to get a driver's license. So I went down there. And I mean, I've been to the Common. What are there more people living downtown? Does it feel more vibrant? Are there great places to grab lunch, to grab a drink after work? Does it feel different than it used to?
You know, I continue to come into downtown during, you know, even in 2020. I am the president of the law firm that I helped found called Dane Torpey. We're a 27 lawyer boutique law firm working with property owners and developers in Boston. So I was continuing to come downtown, and certainly during the pandemic, downtown was completely hollowed out. There was almost no activity going on, both office workers as well as, you know, in the evenings and weekends and evenings have always been a struggle for downtown because of a lack of residential. And, you know, because of that, you don't have as many restaurants downtown as you have, say, in the Back Bay. You know, that's come back quite a bit in the last year or two, but it's certainly not all the way back. We need to come up with ways of encouraging people to come back into the city. But, you know, I love being in downtown. There are, you know, there still are some good restaurants, and downtown is so central. So from my office on Federal Street, I can walk to the Seaport. I can walk to the Back Bay. I can walk to the North End. If there's a Celtics or Bruins game or a concert at the TD Garden, I can walk there after work. I take the commuter rail from where I live in Needham today to South Station and get off. It really meets all my needs. And there are pockets of real activity. High Street Place has been very successful. The Winthrop Center has just opened, which is a new tower on Federal Street, has just opened a new sort of food hall. I think it's called The Connector, which I've walked through but excited to try. So there are some pockets where, you know, the city and landlords are trying to bring people into downtown, but it's still overall quiet compared to where we were in 2019.
Yeah, your point is interesting that Central Boston is so small, so you can, you know, if you're downtown, like you can walk to all these different neighborhoods. They're so close together that you can see why maybe there's more competition because there are just so many options and everything is kind of right there. In order to get people into this pocket that we call downtown, you know, they have to compete against all these adjacent neighborhoods that don't have any more like some of those big barriers like highways and rivers and bridges and all that.
Yeah, I mean, Faneuil Hall and Quincy Market are still considered part of downtown, and that area has really struggled a lot and really calls out for some reinvigoration and reinvention. But I still love it. I still, even though it's sort of touristy and locals don't go there, if I'm down there, I certainly like walking through the hall there. The Greenway is wonderful. That's the land that we uncovered from the depressing the central artery. The Greenway has been very successful, and certainly in the summertime is full of people. When my kids were younger, we loved going to the aquarium. There are lots of activities there. There's a movie theater on Tremont Street off of the Boston Common. The Common itself, public garden are beautiful in good weather. And you can walk to some of the great neighborhoods. When people come from out of town and ask what they should do in Boston, the number one thing I say to people is get out of a car and go into the neighborhoods and walk the neighborhoods. Go walk Beacon Hill, walk the Back Bay, walk the North End, and then even get into the neighborhoods to the south of the city, which tend to be more residential. There's really great ethnic food in some of these neighborhoods. Go get Vietnamese food in Dorchester. You know, go to Nubian Square and check out that area. There's great Ethiopian food and Somalian food in the Nubian Square area. Boston is very rewarding for people that get out and walk it and explore the city.
Were there ever any big ideas floated or projects floated that didn't happen that you kind of feel like are, like a what if?
I mean, it was before I was born, but people woke up after the urban renewal movement in the 50s. And as you know, I think I mentioned that a quarter of the city was slated to be raised as part of urban renewal. And so after the first several neighborhoods, you know, the famous ones again are West End, the New York streets, and Scully Square that are completely demolished. But there's tremendous other urban renewal that there's, you know, some lessons were learned, and it wasn't quite the wholesale demolition, but much of Charlestown is raised in the 60s, and South End and Roxbury. The city gets through the trauma of the Central Artery and the Turnpike. And in the 60s, suddenly people wake up and say, you know, wow, this is enormous displacement. Is this actually good for the city? And there's real pushback and rebellion against continued urban renewal and more highway building. So, for instance, the Southeast Expressway that we have today, which is a parking lot at all times of the day, it was going to have a companion highway called the Southwest Expressway, which was going to go right through the neighborhoods of Boston to connect up with Route 128. It was going to be an urban ring. You know, think about 128 that's out in the suburbs, but think about having a similar loop that goes through the city and through Cambridge. In the 1960s, there was a real effort to say, you know, stop, why are we doing this? That backlash succeeded. And it still took another 20 years after those movements to get people to come back into the city. But if those movements hadn't happened, hadn't succeeded, the city would have been further destroyed.
So what's the future for downtown? Are they going to build a lot of housing? What's going to happen? Are there any projects on the horizon that you think will transform this part of the city and bring back a little bit more life?
Well, between inflation and higher interest rates and uncertainty and Ukraine and Israel right now, and with overbuilding certainly in Boston of the life science sector, of lab space, and then the general fact that offices remain approximately only 60% full right now, there is no lending going on at all for real estate development of almost any product type, except possibly affordable housing in Greater Boston. So the capital markets are totally frozen. So no new projects are happening right now in the city. There are cranes in the city that where developers are completing existing projects. It's not quite as it was in 2008 and 2009 when holes in the ground were left that way. So projects are being finished, but no new projects really are going forward right now because of the capital markets. But there's reason for some optimism on that because the underlying economy remains relatively robust. We continue to be in a period of low unemployment and business profits are strong and the stock market is healthy. You know, as some of these markets stabilize office and lab, and potentially as interest rates come down, you know, hopefully developers will start building again in the city. And we desperately need to build particularly housing in the city to provide the housing in dense places that get people out of their cars and are lower carbon impact. And it's going to be a real challenge to build densely in the city because there's an awful lot of opposition to any change. People don't want to see density coming near where they live. And every project is a major fight. Some ways pessimistic that we have the political will to build the density that we need to do to tackle these crises that we've talked about involving housing affordability and transportation crisis and the climate change crisis.
Heavy. It's so interesting to talk to you because I think you're speaking from both sides of expertise, of both your historical expertise, but also your expertise in commercial real estate, which is, you know, you have a finger on the pulse in a way I think a lot of my guests don't, where, you know, you're speaking very practically about what it actually takes to get a building built. And I've heard from a lot of people, you know, around the edges about that the stubbornness and intractability of getting things done here, getting things built, getting things permitted, et cetera. And then, you know, you add in this financing piece and certainly seems like there's a lot of roadblocks in order to refresh the city in the ways that maybe we would all like it to happen.
We learned a lesson in the 1950s and 1960s from urban renewal and the highway building. You want to energize people and get people involved in decisions in their neighborhood. And the result of that from the 70s and 80s was really important to jumpstart the city again. But in some ways, we learned those lessons too well, and we apply them now to every circumstance.
Yeah.
And so we started saying, it was good when we started saying no for the first time, but when you say no every time, it really is one of the main reasons why we have not continued to build housing, even as demand for housing has increased. As a result, the city is unaffordable to all but the very rich, and it's unaffordable to live, but it's unaffordable in other ways as well. We don't think about the fact, for instance, that hotel rooms cost $500 a night or higher to stay in Boston. And we think, well, we live here. Why do we care how expensive hotels are? But a big part of our economy is tourism or business travelers coming to this area. If you're a tourist and you're not extremely wealthy, you can't afford to visit Boston and stay in the city. Yeah. If you're a business traveler and want to come to Boston, you may not be able to afford to stay in Boston. Rents have certainly stabilized with dropping office vacancies, but even still, office rents are very high. So if you're someone who wants to start a business and locate close to other startup businesses, you know, office rents are remain very high. So the cost of land is making it very difficult for people to be in the city, which I think is really essential to tackle these issues that we're dealing with.
Okay, great. Well, Dan, I end every episode with the same question. Do you have any Philadelphia questions for me?
So Philadelphia is a city that I love, in part because I think in some ways it's similar to Boston in terms of the great historic neighborhoods and the food scene. And one of the things I've wanted to dig into more that I haven't yet is what Philadelphia's experience was in terms of preserving its historic neighborhoods, but also being able to grow. Urban renewal was a federal policy. There were federal dollars that were made available in Boston. How has Philadelphia balanced the importance of preserving the historic neighborhoods, but at the same time continuing to grow?
It hasn't always done it well. And it's like a continued constant debate, I would say. I'm in a bunch of still Philadelphia sort of urban and design policy Facebook groups. And there's always that tension. I mean, Philadelphia had a lot of big urban renewal projects, especially in, we call it Center City, especially in Center City, where they're raised a lot of buildings. They put in a big highway, the Vine Street Expressway. There was supposed to be another highway south. They didn't build it, fortunately. But now I think it's more, Philly is not as rich as Boston. It does not have as much money coming into the city in terms of the tax base, et cetera. But there is a lot of anxiety around gentrification, around overdevelopment. So there's like these two things going on where there's a lot of people want development. They, you know, there's like crazy tax abatements for building. There's been so much work to spur development. But then there's a lot of people saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. Oh, wait, you got some tax break to said you were gonna preserve this historic building. Oh, actually, you decided it was too expensive. And then you're able to say, okay, well, sorry. And then they'll just knock it down. So people are always bemoaning the loss of a building, the loss of a block. There's a very famous street called Jewelers Row in Philadelphia, which always traditionally had all of the jewelers on it and had these very distinct little storefronts and all these great signage. And the Toll Brothers, who are this big mega developer, they came in and they were going to build this big high-rise apartment building. And they at first were going to preserve the facades. And it was one of those projects where it was like, more news kept coming out, the trickle of like, well, no, we're not actually. Oh, we're just going to preserve this. Oh, and then by the end, they knocked all of the facades down. And, you know, you can't get that stuff back. So I think this is something cities are always dealing with. I think Philly, it's like a blessing and a curse that there's less money because it's hard to do projects that are as extreme. And people also are always worried about their parking. And they're always, people hate in the residential neighborhoods, hate density. So that's also a fight that happens there. I don't know if I did a good job answering this question, but, you know, we have a lot of laws. We have a historic society. Stuff can get, you know, a badge from this thing that's supposed to protect it, but it doesn't always work.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're both sort of saying the same thing about Boston and Philadelphia, which is these things are really, really hard to balance creating livable neighborhoods and preserving the things that make the city interesting, you know, and beautiful places to live, but not preserving them in amber and realizing that we have to continue to evolve as cities. And those things are very hard, but if we don't take them seriously and we don't really focus on what cities need in order to stay vital, you know, the lessons from the past in all these cities is that they can really go into decline.
Yeah. And there are some funny, very small examples, like Philly's filled with these 1,000-square-foot, two-story row homes, which you find a lot in Boston, too. And in a lot of neighborhoods, and a lot of people are trying to add third stories because they want to stay in the city. American families these days don't want to live in 1,000 square feet as they have like one, two kids, but they want to stay in the city. And in some neighborhoods, that fight can just be so epic because people are very concerned about the character of the cornice line, but they're also concerned about their light. They're also concerned about their property values. They're concerned about, you know, it goes on and on. And it seems really small, someone just adding a third story to their row home, but it can be kind of a microcosm of all of these issues.
Yeah, totally fascinating and similar issues to what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. So again, you guys have a lot more money here. So
just in the last 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it for this episode of Explain Boston to Me. Thank you so much to Jan for chatting with me. I'm going to take a minute here to mention something personal. This week, my husband's grandmother, Nina Gottlieb, passed away. She was an incredible woman, and I'd like to use my wee megaphone to say that. Dylan's cousin, Daniel Lombroso, actually made a short film for The New Yorker about her life and the loss of her sister during the Holocaust. It's called Nina and Arena, and if you Google it, it should pop right up. It's a story about the things we don't talk about and also a touching portrait of a hilarious, proud, insightful woman. May her memory be a blessing. As always, if you have thoughts on this episode or ideas for topics I should add to my growing list, hit me up on Instagram at explainbostontome or email me, explainbostontome@gmail.com. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe so you never miss an episode. The key art is by Melissa McPheeters. The bed music is by Dylan Gottlieb. Until next time, I'll just be over here thinking about the green bona fides of my urban lifestyle.